unopposed, right? Like all of those traits that I talked about with Beckham, all of them can be trained unopposed on your own. So 80% of David Beckham's game, here's a good one for all the kids to listen to. 80% of his game, you can train on your own beginning today.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the 343 Podcast, where we work tirelessly to elevate the level of discourse and practitionership here in American soccer. Today, we have a guest from the outside. Usually, it's me and Benny shooting the shit, but we're going to make a concerted effort to get some more guests from the outside on here so we can shoot the shit with them as well. Last time, we hosted Rory O'Neill. It was a great episode. It was one of our most popular episodes, actually, where the focus was on U.S. soccer coaching licenses and licensing in general. I would highly recommend you check that out. Maybe it was like three episodes ago. This time we have Paul Spacey on the line. Paul is a very experienced coach here in Southern California. He's been coaching for a very long time. His origins stem from England. Me being from Argentine heritage, there's always been a little bit of a friendly sort of friction between the peoples of Argentina and the peoples of England. Maybe not so friendly at times, being that there was a war back in the day, the Falkland Islands, and in Argentina, we would say Las Malvinas son Argentinas. And of course, there's the infamous 1986 World Cup with Diego Armando Maradona utilizing the hand of God and taking Argentina eventually to a World Cup after defeating England. So we talk about a whole bunch of stuff. We talk about the opposed versus unopposed training debate. I mean, people like to frame it as a debate. I don't think it's debatable at all, frankly speaking. I think this whole thing is quite silly. We dive into so-called research. What is the role of quote-unquote research in soccer? What does that even mean? You all know by now that my background is in physics, it's in mathematics, it's in engineering, and research has a certain meaning there and a certain rigor associated with it. But outside of the STEM fields, how rigorous is research? And if we're talking about something as subjective in many respects as soccer, what does research mean there too? And a whole bunch of other stuff, guys. Honestly, we talk about culture, we talk about level of parity and whether that's a good thing or not a good thing in MLS or elsewhere, on the value of repetition. And we talk about England's chances in the World Cup in 2026. So I hope you enjoy this one. Oh yeah, I should mention, there's a little bit of injection of politics here. So if you're a little bit sensitive to that, maybe this is not the episode for you, even though it's just a tangential sort of thing. But I hope you stick around because, as I've said many a times, politics, culture, societal things, economic things, they are all entangled with soccer, with football. You cannot decouple them. And if you want to treat the game as just the game separate from everything else, you're missing the whole point of the game. Okay, I'll keep it very simple. Coaches, if you want to catapult your careers, go to 343coaching.com. We have free and premium programs for you there. If you're coaching 7 versus 7, you can go to 7v7coaching.com. Parents, you need to know how to guide your kids. How are you going to do that? What resources are you using? Do you know if those resources are any good at all? And whatever field you happen to be a practitioner in, you know damn well that folks outside of that field don't really know much about that field. So how, if you are not a soccer practitioner yourself, how are you capable of discerning who knows their shit in soccer and who doesn't know their shit? It's a very difficult predicament you're in. We try to help. You go to 343masterclass.com. Again, parents, you go to 343masterclass.com. Get your asses higher up on the learning curve so you can guide your kid much, much better. All right, everybody. I hope you enjoy this episode with Paul Spacey. Here we go.
How are you, mate?
Good, man. Long time. What's it been? Maybe like a year or so?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Shit. Is that when we did the last one?
I actually don't know. I can find out right now. Let me see. Let's scroll up here. April 25th, 2024.
No, wait. It was a year ago. If you asked me then to put money on it, I would have said to you it was definitely less than a year.
Yeah, time flies, bro. Especially as we get older, right?
No, it does though. I talk to my wife about this all the time, mate. Mm. Like it does fly. I'm sure I've read there's some science about it that when you get older, it genuinely does go by quicker.
You do remember when you were a kid and there were summers, you know, you're off of school or something like that. The summer seems like an eternity. Like, oh my gosh, I get all of June, all of July, all of August. This is like, a lifetime's worth of experiences that you have. And now the summer goes like this.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. It did seem to last a lifetime when we're young.
Scary. So what's happened the past year? Like I told you, I didn't write down any notes. I didn't prepare. We have plenty to talk about. You know, actually, I kind of want to, but everything costs money, right? It would be great if I could also develop a studio like some of these professional podcasters have and say, hey, Paul, come visit. And I hook you up with a flight or a hotel room. You know, I know you're local, but that would be the best because my best conversations, Paul, are with people I'm having a drink or having a meal. And it's just completely off the cuff, unprepared chats. And at the end of the chat, if it's like a soccer person, it doesn't have to be a soccer person. It could be anybody. I'm like, damn, Joey, or damn, Benny, or damn, X, Y, or Z. I wish we had hooked ourselves up with mics because this is gold, you know?
I know it is, though. It is. And you know, when you're in person and you look that person in the eye and you can sense the energy and you're bouncing back and forth, there's just a better level to it.
Yeah. So I don't know. Did you have anything in mind you wanted to chat? I mean, I could pop up with a million topics.
I know you can. And that's what you're so great at, mate. That's why I respect you. Whether it's soccer or anything else, there's always stuff you can talk about. I mean, look, I've got two or three that I've made a couple of notes on that you've done recent podcasts on. Probably ones that from a coaching perspective, other coaches will be interested in hearing more about.
Go for it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look, we'll start off with one that one of your recent tweets, I think, went fairly viral. The unopposed versus opposed training issue.
Of course. Okay, so tell me your take. I think I kind of have an idea of what you might be saying, but you know where I stand.
Yeah.
And people need to hear where you stand.
Yeah, I think it's just about knowing why and how, or why you do an opposed work. I think that's some of the misconception that people have. They look and they go through these, maybe a coaching course, or they've looked at a study that says, sorry, it's got to be opposed. That's the best way. And they just blindly follow that, without having done any of it themselves or seen the evidence of what does and doesn't work. And I think that's the frustrating part from a coaching perspective, when people have kind of this dogmatic view, right, of I follow it this way, I'm at the end of the spectrum, so yeah, that's the way I know, your way's crap. Sorry, mate, I'm not going to entertain that. And it's ridiculous because if you're a coach with any experience on the grass, you know that all of the ways, unopposed, opposed, semi-opposed, there's value to all of it, but the value comes from your expertise in knowing how and when to apply it. That's the whole point.
Totally. The thing that's frustrating, Paul, is there's a logic to things that I consider incorrect views. Yeah, so even if people have some cockamamie idea, they have a logic that substantiates why they believe what it is that they believe. And so with the opposed thing, there's a logic to it. It's like, well, Gary, well, Paul, I mean, it's not game realistic. It's not the real game if you don't have people pressuring you or an opponent. So it's makes total logic sense, you know? And well, Gary, like you have to teach players decision making, you know, and if you have no opposition in front of you, then they're not flexing those sorts of muscles. So all of this has a logical structure, logical basis to it. And that is what, in my opinion, ensnares so many well-meaning coaches into this. And I think it's an abyss because my perspective is almost like in any skill, you want to start with the base fundamentals first and have some grasp of the base fundamentals before you start introducing complications. Yeah. So for instance, if you want to know soccer, learn how to kick a ball first, right? Don't surround a kid who doesn't know how to kick a ball with opponents when they can't even kick a ball.
No, I mean, look, it makes complete sense. If you've got at the basic level, particularly for young players, let's say you do the 4-3-3 most common formation we see in America, and you want to set the kids up, maybe it's a new team, you want them to understand what spacing and understanding that spacing is all about. Okay, well, let's just have them play 11v11 in practice immediately on half a field and they'll figure it out themselves, which leads on to that other point straight away. The game is the teacher.
Yeah.
Yeah, it can teach, but if the game was the teacher, we wouldn't need coaches. Just let everyone develop from 3, 4, 5 years old and just play games, step back and leave them alone. and we'll produce thousands of professionals at the top level just by that organic process.
Here's where logic gets them again, because they'll be like, well, I think that is true, because if you go to the favelas in Brazil, then there are no coaches. It's total random chaos and the kids do what they want. And look at what Brazil produces. They start with something like that and they lead to the ultimate conclusion of winning 5 World Cups. It's bananas.
It is bananas. Look, and let's go back to the unopposed thing quickly. You set your players up in that 4-3-3 shape, and let's say they're young. Most of them, if it's a new team, have zero understanding of one quick example. Where do I need to be as a right back when the right center back has the ball? Where do I need to be? How can I give them the best option? And the same thing for defensive midfielder or six or whatever you want to call it. Where do I need to be when the left center back has the ball, maybe on the edge of our 6-yard box? Where do I need to be positioned? And if you start that in the ultimate chaos of 11v11 or even less than that, the kids just have no reference point. And again, that's why coaches are there, to help them understand that on a really basic level before they go into the absolute chaos.
Yeah, I was actually quite surprised that the post I made, again, for folks in the audience who don't know, it's showcasing a video caught from elevation of PSG with coach Luis Enrique training 11 versus 0. So I'm presuming it's his starting 11, and he's just having them knock the ball around and advance the ball. And, you know, he's dictating. I can't make out what he's saying, but I'm sure there was an objective and a directive to the exercise, such as either maybe it was quick ball movement, maybe he was working on particular players making certain off the ball movements for ball progression, maybe it was just him. Or also, and him giving verbal commands, saying, okay, we go back, and let's see how the whole blob, you know, retreats and moves the ball back to the keeper and builds out once more. There's a variety of things that can be worked on without the opposition. So here we go. And so that was the tweet. It was that video kind of saying, hey, playing unopposed is absolutely essential, and especially the lower level you are, the younger you happen to be. So imagine what you just said moments ago, Paul, that kids who don't even know the base concept of where to be when certain situations arise in a game, and your example was the right back when the right center back has the ball. Imagine if kids don't even know, right? Or actually, the pros do know, you know what I'm saying? So if the pros at the highest Champions League caliber level are training this thing unopposed, of course, your 14-year-old should be doing this. Of course, your 12-year-old should be doing this. Of course, your 10-year-old should be doing this. I'm not suggesting 11 versus 0 with 10-year-olds. That wasn't the point. The point is like, hey, if you have a little passing exercise, 4 versus 0 or whatever the heck it happens to be, make it versus 0.
Yeah. Look, Matt, let's say this is a common concept that happened in the pro game. We go center back, full back, fire it into the 9 who lays it off to a midfielder for a through ball, and up back through. That concept, how many times if you set kids up in an 11v11, the chaos of that in a half, could they practice that? It won't happen. But the idea is that you're getting that technical repetition and that pattern repetition lots of times so that they're able to do it and orientate the body correctly and receive it perfectly and fire it in at the correct speed and at the correct angle or an advantageous angle. Once you've done that lots of times and they do have that in their muscle memory and their understanding, it's much easier then to go into the chaos of an 11v11 game and try and work on those patterns again. It doesn't work perfectly, but it just gives you a much better chance.
Or even a much better chance just with one defender pressing you. You know, make it 11 versus 4, you know, no problem. Question for you, because you've been training, you've been a coach forever, and for folks out there, maybe you can just give a brief intro to your soccer background as a coach here in the United States. Maybe you want to go further than that. I'm obviously going to reference people to our earlier show together so they can get a history, but just so that they're aware who Paul Spacey is.
Yeah, I'll keep it short. I won't talk about my time in England from when I arrived here 12 years ago.
Yeah.
I spent a fair bit of time refereeing. Got into coaching as a private coach, and enjoyed that. Bought a business from a friend that I met that allowed me to have a visa here. I'm now a US citizen.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, cheers. Yeah, proud of that.
And you can go.
Yeah.
Or maybe you already voted before.
Nothing's stopping me. Nothing stopped the other millions. So it's okay. I could have. I didn't. Anyway, that's another topic. Maybe we talk about that at the end.
Sure.
Yeah. Got into coaching got into club coaching with AYSO just as a volunteer, wanting to help out. Spent a couple of years there, helped them expand their program in Santa Monica or help them run their program, and then eventually started a club with a good friend of mine, Ricky Collett. It was called FC England. And I say was because, after 10 years of doing that, we've just now joined together with Albion Santa Monica, which used to be Santa Monica Surf. And so, I'm 10, 11 years into my team coaching journey now. And I feel like I've learned a lot. Certainly wouldn't call myself an expert in the field. I've probably got more to learn than I've learned in the last 12 years. That's for sure.
Perfect. So with that background, and we were talking about unopposed versus opposed training, do you do unopposed stuff? Like what is a typical session, or what is a typical sort of season long team development thing look like for you with respect to exercises, whether they're opposed or unopposed?
Dictated completely by the team that I'm working with. And I normally end up working with 5 or 6 different teams. So lots of different kids, some of them different levels, different ages. Dictated by the level and quality that I've got in front of me and what the needs of that team are. But I personally spend a lot of time with an opposed. And I have this argument, and we joke among coaches that I work with, and they're like, Paul, it's lots of unopposed work. Where's your opposed work? Mm-hmm. And look, some of the things that are often said are, look, it needs to be opposed. I've done my courses through US Soccer, and they say it's got to be opposed and it must be game-like. And I know Todd Bean at Tovo, who does amazing work. Massive respect to him, by the way. I think he would advocate for opposed work. But I spend a lot of time doing unopposed stuff because I know there is huge value in it, because I see it on the field. I watch it every night, and then every weekend when we're on the games, I look and think, how well has that transferred? What does our team shape look like? Do they have a better understanding? And I'll say it respectfully, I don't need anyone with a study or some bullshit online coming and saying to me, Paul, it needs to be, it's got to be opposed work because of this, this, and this. No, I said in our last podcast, the most valuable or impactful learning is what you see with your own eyes in front of you, not what somebody else will tell you that you've seen in a study. So yeah, I do a huge amount of unopposed work.
Awesome. It's really cool. Man, I get riled up when they're like, Gary, take a look at this article or this research paper, this X, Y, or Z. Oh my God. First off, many a times it's coming from somebody who's not a practitioner, who's sending me the article, or maybe the one who wrote the article wrote the quote-unquote study. And I'm literally putting this in quotes in a derogatory fashion because that takes me down a whole other rabbit hole, right? With respect to what is credible research versus what is not credible research. But many times the quote-unquote researcher also was never a practitioner, is not a practitioner, has no domain-specific knowledge. They're purely looking at some sort of data or some sort of numbers that they do not have the expertise to place in context anyway. And many a times in research, especially outside of the hard sciences, you can get a particular sample of data and then craft a narrative that data, suggests, and throw out all the other data. So when people send me like a research article, I wipe my ass with it. I swear to God, wipe my ass with it. I know, Paul, being in physics, even in physics, there's a lot of cranky sort of nonsense that goes on. And this is like hardcore math, hardcore nature, to the extent that if I let go of this pen, what's going to happen to the pen? You know, it's going to fall. Like that's how close to reality it is. So things outside of that, whether it be medicine, whether it be like psychology, whether it be some of the social sort of studies, sorts of things, and whether it be soccer, just stop. Just stop because I laugh at you.
It's true. Another example of that I saw just this morning before we started this on Twitter. Someone shared a study with German national team players. And one of the parts in there was, they specialized later. They did lots of other sports. And most of these players didn't focus more on football until they were 22 plus. And I read that line and I'm like, but no, I know that's objectively untrue. That's not my opinion. That is objectively untrue. German national team players did not focus more on football after 22. Pure bullshit.
Yeah. I mean, and they can play all these sorts of word games. Well, what we really mean by focused more, it's maybe they focused more, they're more of their time when they were 22 and professionals versus when they were 14, because when they were 14, they were in school and their time was more, you know what I mean? I'm just making some potential, you know, word games, word salad for that they would protect themselves with.
Someone else commented and said, look, I think it's interesting that they did lots of other sports and maybe didn't specialize until later. And I just replied and said, look, respectfully, most of them, if not all of them, would have engaged early. They would have had that early engagement period. And most of them also, frankly, would have specialized early, because that is the trajectory for most professional top level players. And if it's not, you're a pure outlier. It's absolutely not the norm that you do a billion different sports until you're 17, 18 years old, and then suddenly break into the national team of whatever country and you're a top level player. It doesn't work like that. I know we all want it to, so that everyone can be happy and do all their different sports. I get it. I understand it. But that isn't how it works. It's just not the reality.
It's sad. It goes back to sampling, right? I sample this particular one data point or five data points. Well, look at this guy. He didn't start playing. He didn't kick a soccer ball till he was 13 years old, you know, and he's a professional and something. And then you cling to that and you tell a story around that, neglecting the 99.999% generally true statement. My God. And what strikes me so bad is that there are coaches out there who will die on the hill of say, it must be opposed, it must be opposed, it must be opposed. And they have either little experience or they haven't accomplished something of remark, you know, to say, hey, actually, I've discovered a new truth or a new reality sort of thing. Or sometimes they don't even coach, Paul. They don't even coach. They don't have teams, currently or historically even. And then they develop, I'm not mentioning names, then they develop courses and programs and all this sort of stuff. And they're listened to because they're very prolific online. And what really hurts me a lot, my heart, it's not an ego thing, because like I said many a times before, my ego is not attached to soccer. It's elsewhere. But I generally feel bad for the kids that are entrusted to a lot of these well-meaning coaches. Don't get me wrong. They're not trying to do bad work out there. They're trying their best to do good work.
They are well-meaning.
But the kids and the families are falling into this trap because they're being led off a cliff.
It's true. They are well-meaning, but like you said, a lot of them don't have that practical experience on the field, and they're not doing that day-to-day or haven't done it in the past. And it's fine, like you said, coming from a logical perspective, right? This worked because of this, this, and this, but you always say this line, and I love it, and I've repeated it plenty of times. Show your work.
Yeah, yeah.
Show us your work. And quickly on the culture thing again, one last tweet I saw the other day was the top 10 FIFA rankings.
Okay, tell me.
And of those, I think there were eight of those. I believe it's eight. Eight of the only countries that have ever won a World Cup. And those top 10 are the top 10 for a reason. And the reason is very simple. They are football first cultures, period. And if you aren't a football first culture, breaking into those football first cultures is virtually impossible, because those cultures develop a massive swathe of technically competent kids at a young age, and they then have a system that's able to progress them through. So if you're not a football first culture, and you don't have a lot of young kids engaging with that sport from an early age, you're playing catch-up against those countries. And it's an almost impossible game of catch-up.
Absolutely, man. I think, wasn't the USA like in the top 10 back, like early 2000s or late 90s or something like that? Do you kind of vaguely remember that?
No, I do vaguely remember it. Yeah, I do. Yeah. And I think at the time people were saying, we're on the way up. We're going to crack the top five. We're going to crack the top three.
What do you think will happen in 26?
Well, generally speaking, countries that host the World Cup are fairly successful. And I think that's partly psychological, right? You have the backing of the country behind you. You've got however many fans at each game. And we know that home advantage is a real thing. It exists. And so I think that the US, I can say us now, I'm still English. I want England to win. I'm just going to say now, when I'm going to win. But yeah, I think the US will do well because they'll have a psychological bounce from hosting the court tournament and having the whole country behind them. When I say they do or will do well, it will be hopefully getting out of the group stage and playing a knockout game.
Oh, wow. No expectation, man.
To go further than that, after that first knockout game, you are playing against the best nations. So getting past that point, really difficult.
Yeah. Getting out of the group should be really easy this time around because of the expanded tournament.
I forgot all about the expansion. So that actually makes getting out of the group way easier.
Yeah. Who knows? They might be up against an island nation or two, you know.
There's the other point. The gap between the top countries and the bottom countries does narrow. And it has continued to narrow over time because those bottom countries copy or follow some of the stuff that the top countries are doing. And it's inevitable, right, that if you're at the top, staying at the top and continuing with massive improvements is really difficult. And everyone else is making incremental improvements. That gap's always going to narrow over time. So even the really low-ranked countries now in FIFA, they give the top countries a game where it used to be 5-10-0 guaranteed.
For sure. Well, you see it here in CONCACAF also. Is the Central Americans are battling Mexico and they're battling the United States. I mean, they've always given a good shot historically, but now, I don't know, it has a little bit of a different tinge to it. It's like, Panama, yeah, they can beat you. Costa Rica, absolutely. Honduras, they're going to complicate you. Mexico might lose. The USA might lose. And it shouldn't come as such a surprise anymore. It seems like the American fan base is still kind of a little bit in shock when these sorts of things happen. And I mean, even if you look at the results of the past 6 years against CONCACAF, you would think that you wouldn't be shocked anymore.
Well, look, now as the gap narrows between individual players, then that takes you to the point of, well, now it becomes more important what our coaching is like and what impact the coaches are able to have on the team. That's when it becomes more important, right? It's like both of us starting with the same level of kids at 10 years old. We have the same canvas. In 6-7 years, come and look again. There doesn't need to be an argument. You can see who the better coach is. It's obvious.
Right. You know what's weird? I always have this debate with myself. I've had it for years and years and years, and I've written about it a little bit, is when you don't have the same canvas and there's a big disparity, then that forces a lot of coaches to also develop further because all of a sudden it's not 50-50. It's like, you're Real Madrid, Paul, and I am Getafe. You know, how can I possibly hurt you? You know, and so you have to come up with schemas that normally you wouldn't have to come up with.
That's testing your actual ability as a coach, right? Not testing your recruitment ability, which is largely the US youth system. Who can recruit the best players? They become the best teams. Oh, that's the best coach. Okay. Well, no, he's just recruited the best players because he's at the biggest club in the league with a certain badge. And look, that's okay. That's what the system is. But yeah, you want to be judged on what you're able to do with players. And like you just said, if there is a disparity between teams, you do have to innovate. You've got to look at what you can do to impact those teams and individuals that are better than you. How do you fight against them? And that innovation is hugely important the development, both individually and collectively, of teams and the system within that country. And I'm not sure we have that here.
Question for you. I don't want to get you in trouble. I never want to get anybody in trouble. So yeah, if you want to tread carefully in how you answer this, 100%. So you mentioned that your club now has kind of joined or merged or something with Albion. Obviously, Albion, for folks around the country who may not know, very big, very historic club in the San Diego sort of area. I don't know what their current status is with respect to like MLS Next and ECNL and all that stuff. But this has been a common trend that has been forced upon the youth system here in the States that, you know, medium to smaller clubs have to kind of, you know, join or merge with the more traditional large or larger or mega clubs that have the league status or that the league status have been given to them.
Yep.
And so it's sad because you have all this consolidation. You don't have as many independent clubs anymore. And with that comes a whole host of other effects. But was that kind of the impetus of joining Albion? And, you know, maybe you can discuss a little bit about that.
Yeah, that was certainly an aspect. After 10 years of running a small club and only having access to certain leagues, we couldn't get into the what you would call bigger leagues because we tried and we asked and it doesn't happen. There's some politics to it, whether you like it or not. And so for us, we'd had 10 years of building the club and gone from CSL bronze level to having all of our teams in the MPL league, which is the top level of SoCal's league. And at that point, you're then, okay, well, where do we go now? Well, the reality is we can't go anywhere. And so for a lot of our kids and our best players, at that point, people are going, all right, well, I need to move on to X, Y, or Z team to say, I've got to be in college. I've been told to play in college. I need to be in a certain league with this badge. And so I'm going to leave. All right, well, why do you think that you're at this level as a player? Well, it's because you've coached me well over the last 3 or 4 years, but I still need to move on. I've got no choice. Incredibly frustrating as a club and a coach for that to happen. And all you want as an ambitious coach, I'm sure everyone's ambitious. I'm very ambitious. All I want to be able to do is show that I'm able to take players from the bottom to the top in a system or a funnel that's actually open, not one that's closed off at certain points. And I think that's all everyone wants, but we don't have it.
Yeah. It's unfortunate, man. And I think more and more people need to become aware of these circumstances because practitioners like yourselves and, you know, you're kind of muzzled. You can't say the truth because, you know, the monopoly, I'll just call it what it is, just will bury you. They'll say, oh, well, Paul Spacey, you know, has said this or has done that. And so you're blackballed. And so even though coaches and practitioners of all ilks would like to inform the public, would like to have the media bring these sorts of injustices to light, they can't do it. And nobody's holding a gun to your head because that's what they always say. Oh, well, Gary, nobody's telling them to shut up. Nobody's forcing them to say or not say things. Yeah, nobody has to. The incentives are what they are. And so, unfortunately, it falls to the dumbass me who just goes out there and tells everybody because this is a very, very sad state of affairs at the youth level, Paul. Obviously the pro level, and people know I rail against the pro level. Of course, that's the most obvious thing. But at the youth level, it's happening also. And I've spoken over the past year to numerous DOCs or presidents of clubs from across the United States who have asked me for some sort of, I don't want to say advice because they're very intelligent people and I don't want to elevate myself above them in any way, but they know that I have had my battles with the establishment. And so they just maybe are trying to tap into maybe some sort of insight that they could leverage. Yeah. And it was all centered around, hey, Gary, I'm running this youth club. I've been running it for a long time. We have done exceptionally well from a competitive perspective and a business perspective. There are many times we go to tournaments and we wipe the floor with MLS Next teams or we wipe the floor with ECNL teams. And as a consequence of that, sometimes we're no longer invited to those sort of competitions. But then it even gets worse, right? Because say MLS Next, they want to, you know, gulp up everything and control all of it. And, you know, so these club presidents or DOCs will apply to either get into ECNL or apply to get into MLS Next and to do what's best by their business and their families and themselves, of course. And they're just rejected, Paul. And it has nothing to do with the size of their club, because many cases they are of appreciable size. Some clubs might have 30 teams or 40 teams, have great immaculate facilities, have been very competitive, have demonstrated that many of their players have gone to U.S. youth national team camps and things of this nature. So from a merit-based perspective, there's no reason that that club should not be admitted into MLS Next. And I see other clubs who have done jack shit compared to the one that I just described, get into MLS Next or ECNL. And I understand some of the machinery behind the scenes as and how it works. I understand it. I do. But it's literally wrong. It is, we have a moral imperative here. We can't have one company with some bureaucrats saying, Paul Spacey, we like you, you're in. So-and-so, Jack Smith over there, you know what? You wrote a tweet 4 years ago that said, you know, I don't like, you know, MLS's single entity system. Yeah, nah, you're out. Even though Jack Smith, you're the best in the country. It's fucking wrong, dude.
No, look, it's completely wrong. And that's the system that we're in, unfortunately, at the moment.
Do you have any ideas of what to do? Like, what do we do?
I don't know. I don't know. I think having lived here for quite some time, and certainly the LA culture is in LA, it's about who you know, not so much what you know. And I think the reality is, both for this with youth soccer and for most other things, it's getting to the right person and getting to know the right person that can open that door for you. Look, you might not be deserving of having that door opened, but as long as you can find that person and establish a relationship, they might open it for you. And again, that's morally, that seems kind of the wrong way to do it, right? You've got to find a certain person to open a door rather than open a door through pure merit, which is the way that it should be open. So I find that frustrating, but I also am aware, after living here for 12 years, that again, that's the system. And I guess we say it, we have to play the game.
Right.
To an extent.
Right. Just so folks out there don't get super discouraged, I am of the opinion, I'm very optimistic from this perspective. I'm of the opinion that if we do reach a critical mass of educated people in the ecosystem, the establishment, the system will collapse at some point. It won't be sustainable. I don't know precisely the mechanism by which that happens, but step number one is having a critical mass of people understanding what it is that we live in, because I don't think they really appreciate the situation.
No, and that's why the education, right, through your podcast or others online is so important, to inform people, look, this is what's going on. A lot of them live and breathe in this system, this youth soccer system or the pro one, and they can live and breathe it while not being fully aware of exactly what it is that they're in and what's going on. And so the more people that are made aware of that, the higher the chances that we reach that critical mass at some point, that we get to a tipping point that it has to happen because there's so many people behind it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
or somebody becomes motivated enough or has enough resources, has enough wealth, and they create an organization, you know, that is deliberately established to kind of change the system. Like, there's all kinds of ways things can occur. And I know people don't like it when I veer off into things outside of soccer, but it doesn't matter. I mean, as I always say, soccer is a proxy for expressing our values outside of soccer. And so, you know, I always point to things like an Elon Musk, who went out of the box, way out of the box, and disrupted so many entrenched, corrupt industries, starting with, say, PayPal, trying to disrupt the banking industry. Imagine how strong the banking lobby is in Washington or in local governments. And here comes this guy. Obviously, he had a team with him as well. They were called the PayPal Mafia. And they're like, oh, we're going to do online money transactions. And everybody's like, what? That ain't never going to work, you know? And so he builds that thing. And I don't want to have to rehash the whole story, but going electric vehicles, imagine the oil industry, imagine the established entrenched car industry and their powerful lobbies. And like, he went ahead and did it and disrupted the whole thing. And now it's up to the government size thing. Oh, I'm going to go and disrupt the guy. And people are having a fucking cow about it. So I look at things like that as inspirational, Paul, and motivational, and saying, well, if that can happen with those sorts of powers, why can't we do it in a rinky-dinky soccer ecosystem? Of course it can happen.
No, of course it can. Of course it can. Like, Musk's a great example. I know some people don't like the guy. He was heavily supported because he was a climate change supporter, and he got his electric car, so that was great to get away from gas, and a lot of people supported him. And then suddenly, without veering off into politics, suddenly he didn't support the political candidate of one side of the aisle, and then he becomes public enemy number one.
Yeah, it's wild how they flip on you, man.
Really is, though. Really is. Look, I guess we share that. It's not intentional that I'm an anti-establishment guy. Like, this happens organically as you grow up and you're exposed to things. Once you realize, hang on a minute, the healthcare system, the nutrition, all of that stuff isn't set up to try and help me. Once you have that realization as an individual, it opens your eyes and you then go, all right, so maybe this and this isn't fair or right or true as well. And it just makes you question everything. It doesn't make you a conspiracy theorist. It doesn't make you a crackpot. It just means that your eyes are widened to look at everything in a much more critical way than before you were aware of some of those things.
Yeah. And it takes, well, maybe you can ask, I don't know what your perspective on this is. I kind of feel like it takes not just the amount of time that you've been on Earth, but kind of gaining a certain level of expertise, if I may, in a very specific domain and getting to the highest echelons in a certain respect in a particular domain for you to be bumping up against the glass ceiling in a particular domain for you to then finally start realizing the machinery behind a domain and what is required to actually achieve something of remark, and who actually knows what it is that they're talking about, who doesn't know. Because in the very beginning, Paul, I'm sorry I'm rambling here, but in the beginning, like, what, you can't judge folks who know more than you. It is kind of like a view that I have, right? Like, if I hop into a brand new domain, I don't know, maybe I want to get into the energy drink business. Okay. So I go into the energy drink business, I get a job at Red Bull or whatever, and I start learning some things, and, you know, 2 years go by or something. After 2 years, I'm not equipped to judge the guy who created the energy drink business, or the guy who created the chemistry of the energy drinks, or the guy or the scientist in the energy, or the CEOs of Red Bull. I'm not good enough. I don't know enough to judge those folks or people above me, right? I am smart enough or good enough to perhaps judge the level of understanding of the folks who have less experience and less expertise than me. So all of this for me to say, or repackage what you said, that if I look at another industry like medicine, Paul, I am ill-equipped to make judgment calls on almost anything. Or same thing with any industry. I'm ill-equipped. I can't do it. So I have to rely on experts, but I don't even know who the experts are. You are ill-equipped to even know who is a true expert and who is not a true expert.
It is true, though. It's true. Like, for medicine or anything else, let me use a quick example in medicine. Doctors are the experts, right? They've been through medical school and whatever else. So they are the experts. Both my mum and dad in the last 18 months ended up hospitalized because of medication they were taking. Now, they didn't know and understand. I just happened to ask them what medication it was they were taking after they went into hospital, and people will get carried away and go, look, Paul thinks he's a doctor. That's not the point. I researched both medications that they took and figured out that was the exact reason why they ended up in hospital, because of the side effects of those medications. And that's an expert doctor giving them that medication to deal with something that they thought was a problem. Now, again, Paul, being the cocky, arrogant prick that he is, solved that through giving them certain foods instead of that medication without side effects. And I'm not a doctor. Those are the experts giving my mum and dad medication to try and help them. I spent a little bit of time on it and figured out just to give them some food instead to get the same benefit without the side effects. It doesn't mean that I think I'm better than those doctors. It just means they don't know as much as they think they know, and they don't know as much as we think they know. And so we've got to be critical both of them and of everyone else. And look at RFK as another example. Like he's going in wanting specifically, the guy has stood on stage and genuinely wept about it, delighted to be where he is, standing there crying because he wants to help the children of this country be healthier. And everyone looks around and calls him a conspiracy theorist or whatever else. Let's get back to the facts. This is the wealthiest country in the world. We are far, far, far away from being the healthiest country in the world. And so for anyone to go in and criticize RFK, the guy is bulldozing in, hopefully, to a bunch of corrupt agencies to try and make things better for your children. I don't get this thing of hating on someone that is genuinely trying to help. And I veered off there into a different subject. So
No. I think it's along the same lines of, if you are not yourself kind of an expert in a particular domain, it's hard to know who are the experts, yes, true experts in that particular domain. You don't know, because there's always a bell curve, right, Paul? So if we want to stick with medicine, if you want to look at doctors, okay, they all had to go through the credential, right? It's a long educational history, et cetera, et cetera. But there's a bell curve. There are people who are remarkable at their job and in their domain. There's people who are in the middle, completely mediocre. And then there are people like, oh my God, how the hell could you possibly be a doctor? You know nothing, okay? No, I can't judge necessarily where each doctor is on the curve. That's the whole point.
Yep.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Just like maybe a parent who has a kid in soccer, you know, and never played soccer themselves, or maybe they did play soccer, but they never coached, or maybe they coached, but not very much. Like, they can't go into the ecosystem and point out that coach right there is superior to that coach right there. It's very difficult for somebody who it's not your specialty to judge who is good and who's not good. And that's the whole point. So yes, same here. When people start criticizing different personalities in the administration and their prior administration, you're veering off into a subject that you know nothing about, and you are 100% certain that you are right and the people there are wrong. It's kind of disturbing.
Yeah, it is. I think I know in the past I've fallen into that trap. Right, it's easy to the newest shiny thing on the block, you go, all right, I'm suddenly going to talk about that and be an expert. We won't go into it because I'm sure the listeners want to hear about soccer and coaching more. But look, everyone in the last few weeks, as you probably know, has become an expert on tariffs. So
for sure.
Yeah,
for sure. No, but it's all connected. It's all connected. You want to talk about soccer? It's all connected. I just gave you one example of how it's connected.
No, but it absolutely is all connected. It is all connected. And until you become that expert in your field and you climb the ladder, see what doors are closed to you as you go up that ladder, you don't really understand the system and how it works. And once you understand your field and your system and how those doors are closed in your specific area of expertise, again, it opens your eyes or your brain to thinking, okay, so I wonder if this exists in all of these other areas as well. And doors are closed in the same way.
And I am a strong believer that they are. It's all the same everywhere. I think humans, the general tendencies, we're all human. We all have the same sort of wiring. We all kind of organize in similar fashions. And this is just naturally an organic thing that occurs, man, with our systems, is my opinion. I see it in education. Like, I've been teaching at the university level for 15 years at this point. And, you know, I kind of see how the sausage is made there also. And there's a lot of similar things going on, and that whole system is a disaster as well, Paul. It's everything. Once you get to, I don't know, I don't want to like say that we're old. I think we're very young and energetic people with a lot of life ahead of us still. But it seems like once you've lived a certain amount and have reached a certain level of competency in certain domains, like you start realizing that nobody knows anything and we're all making it up as we go along. And it's a miracle that anything works at all. You know what I'm saying? And it's just one big chaotic mess.
It's true. It's true though. Yeah, I think people look around often and look at so-called experts and think, and they have this inferiority complex, right? Well, don't have the inferiority complex. Most of those people that you look up to, they aren't that great. And that's saying that respectfully to them, they aren't that great. Most of them are just focused on what they do and they've been bold and brave and taken some risks to get to where they've got to. They're not especially super smart, intelligent people. It doesn't work like that.
And don't hate them for it. Like if somebody is super successful, if somebody is super successful and has broken through glass ceilings and is a maverick and has revolutionized something, don't hate them for achieving things that perhaps you yourself saw yourself as achieving one day. Because I think a lot of it comes from envy, if I'm being sincere.
It does, right? Don't hate them. Just respect them for the fact that they've put their balls on the line to go and do that and get to that position. Right? Don't hate on the person. Just respect them for what they've done. Now, listen, if somebody gets planted into a position for whatever
then
it
I'm
is.
Hating.
Financial
then I'm
reasons,
hating.
No, like it's, yeah, you can hate on them. If someone gets given a CEO job somewhere or gets given a soccer coach's job because of, you know, whoever their dad is or whatever, hate on them by all means. Hate on them by all means. But yeah, not somebody who gets there through through hard work and being brave and taking risks.
100%, dude. What else you got for me, man? Because we can pull on this thread forever. I'm embroiled. I'm embroiled. Like I never cared about so many of the things that I currently pay attention to.
No,
and now I have to pay attention now. It's like a freaking car accident, you know, on the freeway, and everybody slows down to watch the car accident. You can't help but do so.
No, I'm the same as you. Like I pay attention to all of it, and I want to know what's going on, and I want to educate myself on it because I want to know what the truth is and what's real. Yeah. Like I have a real, real sense from when I was a kid of kind of justice and injustice. And so I'm always trying to, when there's a topic or something going on, I want to find out what the truth and what the reality is and educate and inform myself on it so that I've got an idea and I don't have to be dogmatic and just follow what the mainstream or whatever somebody else tells me. And look, a good friend of mine is almost the opposite, and bless him for it. I feel like he's got a great life because of it. He involves himself in zero social media, none of the kind of pop culture stuff that's going on. He's just no involvement, totally detached from it, and loves it. He'll walk down to the beach with the chair on his back and go and sit at the beach and chill and meditate. And yeah, great guy and loves being detached from everything. Almost the opposite of me.
He's like the modern day monk, except he doesn't have to go into the Himalayas.
Basically. Yeah, he is basically. Another football topic then. You did another great episode recently on repetition and how important it is. We'll just maybe touch on that. I've segued into that from talking about politics.
Sure.
Otherwise, you know what will happen? We're halfway through and we get into politics and people will be clicking off on the podcast. They don't want to listen to anymore.
And that's fine. I've told people a million times, I don't care.
No, I don't care.
If I actually cared, like I would have done everything different, Paul. I would have kissed fucking MLS's ring. I would be a multimillionaire right now. You know, Brian would be an MLS coach. I would be a general manager, like all these sorts of, I knew going in, hey, there's two paths here. Which one you want to take? And I'm like, you know what? Fuck it. You said it, Paul. It's about truth. It's about truth and the pursuit of truth. And once I saw from truth, like you destroy your integrity. Like once you see a truth and you're like, you know what? nah, I'm going to deny the truth and be this other thing or this other person. I can't look myself in the mirror, man. So fuck it. If we talk 15 minutes of politics here and people click off and like, fuck Gary and this Paul guy, I'm out, you know, unsubscribe from everything. Gary, cancel my membership. No problem.
I hear you. No, I'm with you. I'm exactly the same. Yeah, I'm trying to think of where my train of thought was just going to lead me then. But I'll go on to repetition in a sec, but just to finish off what you just said, yeah. Because you're spot on. I share that view because the main reason is I go to sleep very easily at night. And my family and my wife will often say, you just get into bed and you shut your eyes and you're gone in like 30 seconds. And I'm like, yeah, because I've had a great day. I've worked hard, but I'm happy going to bed and comfortable going to bed that I'm being honest, both with myself and with other people, and trying to find out the truth of whatever it is that I'm working on or whoever I'm working with. And when you do that, when you've got real integrity and you're not bullshitting yourself through the day, it's so easy to go to sleep when you go to bed. Now, I don't want that internal pain and that internal strife of knowing that you're lying to yourself and other people just to kind of get to where you want to go. That's not a legitimate way to get somewhere. Not for me, but not everyone shares that view.
You're right, man. Peace of mind. There's nothing like it.
No, there isn't, though. There's not.
The alternative is pure stress. Yeah, but go ahead. Repetition.
Repetition. It was a great episode. You had talked about how important it is for developing individual and providing, I think you said a good point, providing that repetition is not reinforcing bad habits, especially at an early age. And I was chatting to a friend of mine who used to live here in America, but now he lives back in the Netherlands. He sent me a few videos about Beckham, and we were chatting about Beckham, and I kind of made the point to him that Beckham's first touch, his passing range, his ball striking, even I guess his exceptional fitness, they're all kind of trainable things. They're not things that he was given genetic amazing gifts for. They're all trainable things that can potentially be trained through the right type of repetition. And he replied to me and said, wow, I didn't look at it that way, Paul. I just looked at Beckham and thought, what an unbelievable player. But you don't really understand or realize, hang on, he's that unbelievable player 90% because of his hard work, his repetition. And the last point, which is a big one, is the guy's mentality. He went through a lot of shit and became really, really strong mentally. So yeah, the repetition thing, it was a great episode. And I think it's just important for young players and parents particularly to understand how crucial that is for young kids to develop, whether it's a ball in a wall, a ball in a friend, but shooting, dribbling, all of the basic stuff. Everyone looks at the top players and says, wow, look, he can dribble past 9 people, or he can shoot free kicks from 40 yards and put them in the top bin every time. The guys practiced it millions of times from when they were 3, 4, 5 years old. It's just repetition. It's not something handed down from God. All right.
And unopposed.
Unopposed. Unopposed, right? Like all of those traits that I talked about with Beckham, all of them can be trained unopposed on your own. So 80% of David Beckham's game, here's a good one for all the kids to listen to. 80% of his game, you can train on your own beginning today.
Yeah. Unopposed, man. It's key. Everything is key. Opposed is key also.
Yeah.
But I mean, when you're outside of the team training environment, what is it that you're doing? You're doing it. You're doing unopposed stuff.
Right. Aside from when you might be playing pickup with friends, right? Pickup soccer or whatever else, you're doing all unopposed stuff. It's on your own. You don't need, this is the beauty of, I know you do it with other sports, baseball and whatever else, hitting, but certainly in football, the beauty of it is you can go away and practice every day for 2 or 3 hours over a period of 3 or 4 years and transform yourself from an average player to a really, really good one just through the consistency of unopposed individual practice. Literally, that's all you'd need to do.
100%. And speaking of Beckham and that Man United era and all that stuff, you reminded me of, I think Ferguson made some comment. No, it wasn't Ferguson. It was Forlan. Diego Forlan, the Uruguayan striker who played at Man United, I don't know how many seasons, a couple seasons or so.
Yeah.
He was telling a story about who he thinks like had the best technique or whatever. And it was like Paul Scholes, that Paul Scholes can just rip like daisy cutter passes, 6 inches off the ground, and just hit the post of the goal at will sort of thing. And it was just remarkable and amazing. And that he would just train that, not for Lan. Scholes would train that by himself 4 hours before and after sort of training. So I don't know. For some reason that came to mind, man, because I like Paul Scholes. He's probably my favorite Man U player of that era. Don't ask me why, because it's hard for me to put my finger on it. He was a bulldog. He was short in stature, and his technique was off the charts. And in that sort of era, he stood out as an English player to me. I don't know why, Paul.
I think he stood out to everybody. And one of the most disappointing things is, as an Englishman, he probably didn't stand out enough to English people and English coaches and English media. He stood out to people that were outside and that could perhaps see his talents for what he had. And look, Paul Scholes is a great example of someone that he absolutely did not get gifted anything genetically. He did not.
Right.
Small guy, not ripped in any way, like not an athlete. Hey, we've just got to get our best athletes in the US playing soccer and we'll be great. Paul Scholes, a perfect example of that's absolutely not the case. Again, all of the stuff that he was great at, trainable traits through repetition. Again, he didn't get those genetic gifts that some others have got. I mean, bless him. They even gave him ginger hair to go with it.
But right.
Poor guy, but he still managed to be outrageous. And you listen to interviews of Zidane and other players talk, and who's the best player you played against? Paul Scholes. Just a little genius.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong. I know Gerrard, is on Mount Rushmore, and Lampard is on Mount Rushmore or something. My personal taste, I know they're phenomenal, but I never, like, no, they're not my, they're not delightful for me to watch. I don't know why, man.
No, it's interesting that, because you're Argentine, it's interesting that you have that view, because if there was a choice between Scholes, Gerrard and Lampard, and Scholes was always third choice for England in that he got pushed to the wing, not a wing, never a winger. So play the guy in the middle and let him dictate the game. If there was a choice between those three for probably a French team, a Brazilian team, an Argentinian team, a Spanish team for sure, all of those countries, with no question, would select Paul Scholes first to be part of their system.
I think so. No? I don't know.
Other people might listen to this and go, nah, Paul, you've got no idea. I think they would choose Paul Scholes because of his traits and abilities, and how he would fit into the way they play. Whereas Lampard and Gerrard, very much sprinting box-to-box players, right? Gerrard could do it all. Exceptional player, by the way, one of the best England's ever had. Was given genetic gifts. He was a tall guy, strong, absolute machine. And then Lampard's obviously standout ability was unbelievable timing to arrive and score on the edge of the box. Outrageous timing. But Scholes would be top of the list for those other countries. He just wasn't there for England. And I think that might have changed now a bit. If it was today's game, Scholes in England would be valued more. But that's just how it was then.
Hey, you don't think England has a chance, man? Look at the players. Bellingham, you got Declan Rice scoring better goals than Messi, even though, what's curious is the MLS guys. I saw a couple of ex-posts. The MLS guys, after Declan Rice's goals, obviously they're praising it, but they're like, but for me, Messi's free kicks have been better. Messi's free kick against Liverpool, you know which one I'm talking about, right? Where he's
smashed it
is better. And fine, we can all have our opinions, but it's interesting because since Messi is in MLS, they have to prop up Messi and say, why even bring it up? Just enjoy Declan Rice's two incredible free kick goals the other day.
two unbelievable goals, to do that twice in the same game, in the way that he did, in that level of game, under that pressure. Unbelievable for Declan Rice. In fact, look, I'm wearing an Everton shirt. The last player to do that in that type of fashion for two goals in the same game a long time ago, Leighton Baines, a left back, did something very similar. But yeah, outrageous, really, Rice scoring those two goals.
You don't think England has a chance, dude? You guys have good players, man.
I want to, Gary. I want to be really optimistic and positive after, what are we now? I'm probably 37, 38 years into truly supporting them and wanting them to win. It grates on you after a while, mate. You get to those finals or the semi-final and you're like, we can do it this time. We can do it. And I've driven down the freeway listening to England songs before the final with tears running down my face, like at the pride of, we're going to do it this time. We're going to do it this time. And then you're ultimately left disappointed after the game. And you can't quite get over that final hurdle. I don't think it's a case of ability for England now. We've got quality coming out of our ears. I think it's psychological, and the players and the team in general have to collectively, psychologically get over that hurdle and barrier of, we're going to win it. I think it might have been Tuchel that said recently, we need to arrive at the tournament and have everyone look at us and really believe, hang on, this is the team to beat. Because realistically at the moment, everybody just looks at Argentina as that. And Argentina swagger around the field, on and off the field, in that way. And I think that's been a big part of their success. There's that swagger.
Psychology.
Confidence and arrogance. Like, that's the psychological part of the game. Like, that's not whether you're good with your feet or not. That's having absolute individual and collective belief that you guys are the best and you're going to win. And I'm not sure England have made it past that barrier, certainly in the
tournament. At the youth level, do you think that also applies? If your team has the psychology, do you think it matters?
100% applies. 100%. You know, when you arrive at a game as a coach and you look at the other team, and two things really. One, the kids are either walking or running around with a real arrogance and chip on the shoulder. Two, they look like they are absolute players, and they're set up and dressed and carrying themselves like they're really good. Very, very, very rarely does the game kick off and it turns out that those kids and that team are not good. The psychological part is massive, massive. And you try and spend some time on it, right? You're with players 3 or 4 hours a week, but there's only a certain amount you can do. I would love to spend 2-3 hours a day with a team 5 days a week over a period of however many years, helping them on the psychological side as well with all the football stuff. And look, that's one of my plans. That's one of my intentions. I want to do that at some point, to maybe a 6, 8, or 10 year project, to be able to at the end of it say, look, this is what is possible if you follow a certain process. And then at that point, no one can really argue with you. Until then, it's just kind of conjecture.
I wrote down something here because I want to ask you on the England topic, and then winning the World Cup and possibilities and all that stuff. Look, I'm being honest. In South America, we don't like the English. We just don't like the. No, I'm serious. And many I say us because obviously I'm of Argentine heritage and how I grew up and how I viewed the English influence in the American soccer ecosystem, right? And American soccer wanted to emulate the English way of 4-4-2 or long balls, you know, and being direct. Historically, right now it's changed a lot in England. Okay,
right.
But historically, it was all about that, and who was, you know, big, strong, fast, physical. All that sort of stuff was kind of anti South American and anti Spanish. So there's always been this kind of friction.
I don't get that.
And so here comes my question. Right? Is man, like, if England wins, I have something in the back of my head, some trauma that the English would be insufferable, you know, if they were to win, you know, forever, like you wouldn't hear the end of it. They would say, you know what I'm saying? Like, is that true? Or would they take the winning with grace?
What an amazing question. Perfectly phrased. I am going to give you a direct and really honest answer. Maybe not every English person shares my view, or yes is the answer to your question. We would be utterly and totally insufferable. Here's what would happen immediately. If we won the World Cup, I'll tell you right now, my emotions would not be able to stop me from going on Twitter and writing a very simple sentence and pressing post. It came home. And look, the kind of arrogance of that, people are listening going, well, you prick, this is why we hate England. Well, yeah, I get it. I completely get it. But yeah, if we won the World Cup or even the Euros, if we won either, the English would be completely insufferable. And for a short period, I think I'd probably be insufferable.
Do you think that might be a reason? Well, actually, I don't know if this statement is true. I was going to say, do you think that might be the reason also why, if not the rest of the world, a big chunk of the rest of the world does not want you to win?
100%. And again, I understand it completely. And if I'm not English, I do not want the English to win. I want England to be out in the group stages getting slapped. I want them out immediately so that the English media, the English fans, and to an extent, people like me, just shut the f*** up. I completely get it.
We've got the best league in the world.
Yeah.
We are the best national team in the world. We're the best at everything.
There's definitely an element of that mentality. And I think outsiders also look, or non-English people also look and go, well, you've continued with that mentality despite not winning anything since 66. Mm-hmm. Like you're 60 years away or whatever from winning anything, but you still think you're the best. You've got the best league. You've got the best national team. Other people just look at that and go, delusion, arrogance, period. And to an extent, they're right.
Yeah, okay. I've never asked that question before. It's always been just in the back of my mind, like, oh my God, like we cannot have these guys winning the World Cup. It'll be a disaster. And look, Argentines are very arrogant people as well and stuff. But for some reason, this time around, maybe it was Messi that transformed everything. Okay, but for some reason, the world was behind Argentina and the world was delighted and wanted Argentina to win, even though, you know, we're well known for being cocky and arrogant and turning a lot of people off with that sort of posture.
No, I think that's true. And I do wonder, you're more of an expert in physics than I am, and I don't know if this is a physics thing, but I do wonder if that sentiment and energy and the stuff surrounding that can help a team to go and win like Argentina did. If you've got the whole world against you, rooting against you, and the energy that comes from that and the dislike and disdain, I wonder if that does have an element of working against the team psychologically, whether you can feel it or see it or hear it or not. Something I can't answer, but I'm sure the energy experts and the mediums would be able to answer that for us.
Yeah, it's definitely not a physics thing, but that's curious because if you think about like Floyd Mayweather, he has the whole world against him forever and it didn't matter. Like he fed off of that and, you know, or Conor McGregor, same sort of thing. Like everybody wants the guy to lose. They hate him. And I don't know, for some reason it propels those guys to be great.
Yeah, I think that's the opposite side of what I just said, right? If as an individual, especially more so than over a team, right? Because on a team, you're relying on other people. But if it's as an individual, you just use that as pure fuel. What better fuel than to have every day from every angle, people telling you, I want you to lose. You're not good. You're not great. Every day, that's like, keep telling me that, mate. Keep telling me that, mate. I'm going to work harder and harder and just show you I'm the best.
Do you think that's usually the reaction or is that the exception to the rule? That the rule is more, if people are against you or think you can't do it, is the rule that that person will fold?
Yeah, I mean, look, I would imagine that's probably the rule for 99 or 99.9% of people. And if it wasn't, everyone would reach that top, the pinnacle, right?
Is it a requirement that you not be that type of player? I'm thinking about youth again, youth soccer, right? Because parents are always, and coaches are like, oh, you have to always work on their confidence. You can't be negative almost ever, you know, towards an individual. And I've always said that here in American soccer, particularly at the youth, but at the pro level also, very soft. very soft. And I think an ingredient to be great is you can't have a soft culture. You can't have a soft environment. But that seems to go against what we just discussed. Yeah, that if you're hard on somebody, they'll just fold.
Yeah, I think, look, I'm definitely a big believer that if you don't go through lots of difficult moments, you can't be great. It doesn't matter what it is, whether it's football or anything else. Without going through lots of, well, for what, no other way of putting it, without going through a lot of shit, you can't be really good. Or you've got less chance of being really good. And I definitely see it in youth soccer. A lot of the kids I work with, I'll be respectful because I live there. Santa Monica is obviously an affluent part of Los Angeles. People are wealthy. The kids kind of do get what they want. And some things are put on a plate and parents often try to remove the roadblocks from their lives to make it as easy to navigate as possible. That is not good for competitive sport. It's not good. And look, normally when you come up against a group of kids that are the opposite to that, I'm sure you've experienced this. We'll go and play in East LA. Some of those kids don't have anything. You know, they're just playing soccer all day, every day. They turn up and they will, just like when I played, I described this on Twitter, they will walk over you and bite you and do whatever is necessary to win a game of football. And that's a mentality. That's something that you develop over time from being, whether it's immersed in that among friends or in a specific culture, but it's necessary, I think, to be really good at sport. And certainly in soccer, that's the case. I try and artificially insert into the teams that I coach by making things difficult for them and talking to them in a certain way so that they can probably experience things that in their normal day-to-day life and certainly in school, they don't experience that. And you can have some impact, but yeah, it's not the same as doing that organically, culturally.
For sure. Paul, we usually keep these to 1 hour.
No, so. I know. I was about to say to you, Gary, I've only got 5 minutes anyway. Now I'm a citizen. I've got my passport appointment coming up.
Oh, no kidding. Okay, cool. So that's more important than this for sure. Any parting remarks? Where can people find you and any other thoughts that you might have?
I suppose the best place to find me is Twitter. I'm sure you'll put the link in the notes,
yep.
But yeah, at Paul J. Spacey. Spend a fair bit of time on there back and forth with people. And it's a great place to go and bounce ideas off others and argue a little bit and learn. But outside of that, no, come and find me on the fields somewhere in Los Angeles. I'm out coaching every night. I'm always at games. So come and find me.
Cool, brother. All right. Let's not wait a year to do it again.
No, let's definitely do it again in less than a year this time, mate. And hopefully at that point, we'll just anger people to finish off with. Hopefully at that point, the US is not on fire as people are currently describing it. We're heading into the golden era, mate. It's a golden age. People need to be positive and looking forward to what, not just the next few years of this current presidency and administration, but the next 5, 10, 15. I don't get any American that doesn't want the country to succeed. And it feels like some people want it to fail. It's a bizarre childlike concept to me.
Yeah. Have a long view, man. Don't react to the day to day. Look out 5, 10, 15, 30 years. Yeah.
Absolutely.
All right, brother. Good luck with the bureaucracy.
Appreciate it, mate. Great time to you, Gary.
Later, man.
See ya.
Well, that's it for today, guys. Thank you for listening. A reminder for coaches, you can get both the free and premium coaching programs at 343coaching.com. Don't let anyone tell you your teams can't win by playing dominant possession-based football while also developing individual players to the highest levels. Nonsense. We've proved it at every single level, and so have hundreds of serious member coaches across the country. Now that we've moved on to the pro level, we're delivering everything we've learned in the program. Don't wait and continue delaying getting on a proven path. And parents, 343masterclass.com is where you want to go to get a working compass for navigating the American soccer landscape with your player. It's pretty bad out there, but let our experience guide you. Lastly, if you're coaching 7v7, we've got you covered there as well. Go to 7v7coaching.com. Until next time, cheers everyone, and keep building.